ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us back down that road in Florida this week once again, and tells us all about his personal history in wrestling as well as everything that was happening all around him. But without any further ado, the man of the hour, the leader of the Studcast, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. Ron, how's it going today?
I'm just great, my man. Down here in the Smokies, man, looking out there, a little snow on the mountains. Just ready to roll with it, man. Got the horse all saddled up. Got another good one today, I think.
You know, as we're recording, you know, it's cold everywhere. It's cold up here in the Northeast. It's cold in the Smoky Mountains. Florida's warm, and we're going to return to Florida in just a moment. But I know we wanted to say a big thanks to all the fans of the Studcast and the Super Studcast, all those patrons of the Studcast, for their great comments and the tremendous support for the latest Super Studcast number 13, part one of the Knoxville Wrestling War, as well as last week's Studcast with Cowboy Bill Watts. Ron, what have you thought of the reaction you've received?
Oh, great. You know, I mean, that's one of the rare times that we've had a live guest, and it works out perfectly. He's highly involved in the angle that turned Dusty Babyface, biggest angle in the history of Florida wrestling, and did a great job. It's always great to have him on the show, and he's done a great Super Studcast for us, a really good one as well. So, you know, if fans want to go and listen to some more Bill Watts, they can find him on a Super Studcast, and they can listen to that one last week. Get a little taste of the big cowboy there, too.
Absolutely, they could do that, but I mentioned Florida, and we are returning to Florida today. Usually at the end of every episode, Ron, I say, where are we going next week? But this week, we'll start by me asking, where are we going this week?
Well, you know, let's start off with a little bit of a recap, since we did have an unusual show last week with a special guest, For those fans that may have missed it, Cowboy Bill Watts joins us live to describe the exciting Dusty Rhodes switch to Babyface. And it was truly an exciting switch. Bill did a great job, obviously, of setting the stage for the biggest Babyface turn in Florida wrestling history. We got to listen to a tremendous audio of the match that started it all between Eddie Graham and Mike Graham against Dusty Rhodes and Pac Song. And Gary Hart was the manager of Rhodes and Pac Song. It was an unforgettable evening for 6,000 fans in the Homer Hesterly Army, and it set the stage, obviously, for the biggest box office year ever for championship wrestling from Florida, and that's 1974, and it is due to the angle that we talked about in episode 79 last week. So let's just jump right into it, Brian, if you don't mind. Today, we're going to begin on the Monday following that legendary babyface turn. And after the Florida fans statewide have an opportunity to watch their respective TV shows on Saturday. So this angle took place on Tuesday. On Wednesday, went through television. Dusty makes his first live interview with the audience, which was a tremendous interview. I thought it really set the tone for him as a babyface from then on. Fabulous interview. And then all these fans, as that tape went rolling around in every market in Florida, and they didn't bicycle it like we used to do in the old days, so that one week it was in one city, and the next week it was in another city. They produced each one of these programs, and everybody saw the same program on Saturdays. So So I'm wrestling on Monday night in West Palm, in the town I'm the local promoter in, and I'm wrestling there most of the time. Going to be in Orlando quite a bit in this upcoming summer here in 1974. But I'm in West Palm that night wrestling against Buddy Coat, and I got a shot at his North American title, which he's recently won from Cowboy Bill Watts. But the real news for me is going to come from Orlando, Florida that night, because that's going to be the first time Dusty Rhodes ever enters a ring as a babyface. And I'm really curious about what's going to happen in Orlando, because I was there on that Tuesday night, watched that match live, saw that television program, saw that Dusty interview. I just said, this has got the makings of being something absolutely phenomenal come Monday as the new week starts off of that tape. And I'd ask Dick Steinborn, who is the son of the local promoter in Orlando, Milo Steinborn. I asked Dick on a Sunday, call him up, in fact, and I said, can you do me a favor? I really want to know what you're going to draw on Monday, how the crowd is. And can you call the West Palm Beach Auditorium, gave him the auditorium's number, and told him to ask for a gentleman that runs the auditorium there named Ralph Boyce, and tell Ralph what the crowd looked like there in Orlando that night. So obviously I was very curious about it, and I knew it was going to be a big house, but I had, you know, I didn't know how big it was going to be, and nobody else did, in fact, on that night. But so as this program airs across the state on Saturday, Monday night in Orlando, I'm waiting in West Palm for the news. I want to get a call from Dick Steinborn, and about 8:30, nobody back there. It was probably about 9 o'clock before the manager of the auditorium comes back to the dressing room. And he says, Ron, I got a call from Dick Steinborn. And I said, what did he say? And he said to tell you that they set an all-time record crowd tonight in Orlando, 30 minutes prior to the start at 8:30. So in other words, they were totally sold out at 8 o'clock, and the matches aren't going to start for 30 more minutes. And then Ralph continued on. He said, Dick said that thousands and thousands, maybe more people outside than there were inside, when 8:30 arrived. And it's when they put the signs up in the windows, the ticket windows, that the building was sold out. He said that people refused to leave, and there were thousands of them on the outside of the building. He was afraid that they were going to try to break in, because that's an old building. It had open sides on the building. You couldn't get through it. There were wires there, but people were concerned that people are just going to break into the building and we'd have a real mess there. So they called the police, and the police came and made everybody leave the property. Probably took 30 minutes for that to happen. But just shows you what a remarkable angle it was. And what happened that night is just going to be just like that all summer long. It's just the beginning of a remarkable run of sellouts that seem like they take all summer.
How often did you get sellouts in advance? How often was the sellout based on the walk-up? And in that day and age, how important was the walk-up?
Well, the walk-up was everything in that day and time. You're talking about 1974. There's no StubHub. There's no place you can go buy tickets for events in advance. The best they could have had is some ringside tickets would have been available at some like grocery store or some furniture store or some place that they had some type of arrangement with that you could go and buy ringside tickets. But they had to be prepared for a huge crowd. They were, obviously, if they got them all in there by 8 o'clock, they had 30 minutes to sit there and wait for the matches to start. They did a great job in getting everybody in there. But there were no advance sale tickets, basically, in those cities back in those days. And everything was walk up. So, you know, the walk up was just astronomical. It must have been amazing to be there and to see that.
How far back did you go with Dick Steinborn?
Dick Steinborn and I went right back to when I came there in 1970. Dick was a great wrestler out of the Northeast up there, and he was a star long before he should have been a star. A lot of people said it ruined his career because he made it so big early on in life that he never could get back to that stage again. He wasn't pushed after he was at the beginning of his career. I don't know how all that started, but Dick Steinborn used to run a couple of little small towns that Milo Steinborn ran, his father ran. And one of them was O'Galley, Florida. It's right there close to Melbourne, And he actually took the first wrestling picture I ever took in my life. I'd been there for about a month, and I was being booked every Wednesday in O'Galley. I never got to do Miami. I was a young guy, and I never made that Miami card much in the beginning. So I was stuck in that little spot show, same as I was on Tuesdays. I didn't do Tampa. I did Fort Myers. But Dick Steinborn was always there, ran the town for his dad, was a great photographer. And he asked me, he said, "Ron, let me take a picture. You ever had a wrestling picture?" I said, "No, I haven't, man." So he took my first wrestling picture ever for me. And it wasn't that good, to be honest. He had me crank my body around, and, you know, I didn't feel comfortable with it. But you know, it was a start for me, and he did give me the photograph right away, got it photographed for me, and I was able to sell a few pictures in my first year with it.
Ron, one more thing before you continue, going back to the whole idea of the walk-up, you mentioned they sold out a half hour before opening match. What's the earliest you remember hearing about a walk-up sellout?
I never heard of one that fast. I never heard of anybody being sold out 30 minutes prior. It probably happened in Knoxville Coliseum on a couple of world championship matches, 77 and 78, maybe, in which they were sold out prior to the start of the matches. But 30 minutes prior, that's a really big, big thing. And obviously, you had the fire marshal there. And, you know, I guess word got around after this angle that, you know, you need to go down there and check out that building because it's going to be a big crowd. And that Orlando Stadium, it had no air conditioning in it. It's hot. We're talking about being in late May, and it's really, really hot in that building. Those people were sweating their rear ends off, but gosh, they were lucky as hell to be in there. And I'm sure there wasn't a darn person that was in there that was unhappy about having to sweat a little bit. It must have been a great event there in Orlando that night.
It was just one of many nights, one of many sellouts that summer in Florida.
Yes. I mean, it's just the very beginning of it. It's the very first one. I'm going to say it's the first one because it's going to be at least 2 months before we fail to see a sellout and turn away crowd. It's just that the business just explodes literally in every building. Every building in the state, no matter how large they were, they weren't able to handle the demand for the seats. They just weren't big enough. And I would see myself as an example the next night in Tampa. I'm going to defend my Florida title against one of the best of all time, Johnny Valentine. And imagine this card, if you will. Now, this is the very first week after Dusty has turned babyface. This is the card on May 21st, 1974 in Tampa. It's a steel cage match with Watts, who defeated Buddy Colt. Pac Song, managed by Gary Hart, defeats Dusty Rhodes by disqualification. The AWA champion, Vern Gagne, defends the AWA championship in Florida against a guy called Redbeard. My match, I spoke of earlier, I'm wrestling Johnny Valentine on that card, and I won my match. Hollywood Blondes with Sir Oliver Humperdinck defeated Don Morocco and Danny Hodge. Pretty darn good team right there. Les Thornton defeated Kevin Sullivan, and Lorenzo Perini defeated Salento Rodriguez. Just an absolutely amazing card. And I tell you what, in my opinion, Brian, Dusty and Pac Song, one match, if they had just booked one match card with Dusty against Pac Song, that building would have sold out anyway. They would have all paid the money just to see that one match. So when I started going to the building that night, I got down there in the area of the building about 7:30, between 7:30 and a quarter to 8 probably. And you couldn't get within a mile of the building. It was just absolutely unbelievable, the traffic and the cars and the people crossing the streets. I never made it around to the front of the Homer Hesterly Army to see what the line looked like where they were selling tickets. But I can imagine that people were standing in a line, probably four people wide, maybe 100 yards long. in probably three or four windows. So it duplicated the night before in Orlando with a massive number of people lined up outside. No way to put even a fraction of them on the inside of the building. And obviously, there was such a huge crowd after it was sold out, and it sold out prior to start time. There was people that just didn't want to leave. The crowd just wants to stay there. They want to hear the cheering from the outside of the building. It's like if you had had one of those big video screens, you could have put them up out there. You could have probably charged. You might have doubled the crowd, doubled the house if you had sold tickets for those big old video screens, if they'd had them in those days, which they didn't. But anyway, they have to do the same thing they did in Orlando. They have to call in the police, and the police have to disperse the crowd. And it's going to be that way every night in every building for months. I become so accustomed to it, and so did all the boys, that the first night that we saw one that didn't have people standing outside that couldn't get in, it was a shock. It was like, oh my God, what's wrong? What happened? You know, it's just, it was an amazing angle. It was an amazing couple of months. Never be another period like that again in the history of the Florida or any other place, probably in that, for that matter. And just, it was wonderful. Just be a part of it, just to experience that, those type of crowds and the enthusiasm. It seems like when people are left outside an arena and they're concerned about getting in, that once they get inside, they have a better time than they ever would have otherwise. It just jacks the crowd more because I got the ticket. I'm going in. I'm going to see it. And then when you look back there over your shoulder at those thousands that are standing outside that are not going to get in, it just it somehow just makes that event even better for people.
Despite all the success and all the big crowds and the mania around the different events, was there anyone in the back who was cranky about it, who didn't like either the direction that Florida was going or was just negative while all this amazing positive stuff was happening for the company?
You mean the boys?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, no, man. You know, I mean, the guys are just, they're lit up. They're like the crowd. You know, they're like, wow, look at this, man. It's just unbelievable. And the old Armory there, you had the big windows. It didn't have any air conditioning in that building either. And they had windows, the big old windows that you pushed out and had a little lever that you put into a slot and it held the window out. And everybody was hanging out the windows. Guys were hanging out the windows just seeing the crowd. It was just amazing how many people were just, they were flooding in there. And yeah, everybody was just going crazy. I mean, it was, nobody had any idea it was going to last as long as it did. But it just got off to a rocking start. That's for darn sure. And then, you know, let's talk about another card on May 28th. This is about a week after this card. And this one is another spectacular one. I mean, what's happening here is you've got this tremendous angle. You've got this tremendous talent built around that angle, but not just that angle, but every match on the card is darn good talent, really great wrestlers, and it just builds upon itself. The evening, as it goes on, the crowd gets more excited, and they get more into it, and it's just, it's amazing to be a part of that. On the 28th in Tampa, the NWA Championship match, Jack Briscoe is the new champion, and he defeats Don Morocco by DQ. And Morocco substituted for Bobby Duncan. It was going to be Bobby Duncan's first night. And they were going to put him right in the ring with Jack Briscoe on top, his very first night in the territory. And for some reason, Duncan doesn't show up. I don't know, it was flight problems or whatever it was. And they take Morocco and move him out of a match and put him up into the main event against Jack Briscoe. Strange event. Strange things went on back in those days. That's a babyface world championship match. Where else in the world probably have you ever seen a babyface world championship title match?
How good was Morocco at that point in his career?
Morocco is a kick-ass guy. He is young. He's got a great body. He's almost a duplicate of Jack Briscoe. He has a lot in his style that replicates Briscoe. And to watch those two guys wrestle each other in a babyface match, it's like watching two Jack Briscoes in the ring at the same time. Jack was just a phenomenal wrestler. And Morocco stays right with him during the course of that match. Underneath that match, obviously, you got the Dusty Rhodes and Mike Graham. They're going to defeat Pac Song and the Samoan, managed by Gary Hart. Below that, it's Harley Race. On this card again, Jack's the champion. Harley's the ex-champion. I think Bill Watts is using Harley well because he doesn't know. He knows that the belt's probably going to go back to Harley. And so Harley's there that night, and he wrestles and defeats Salento Rodriguez. But he's scheduled to wrestle Don Morocco. That would have been a hell of a match. Harley Race and Don Morocco, that would have been a super match, too. Buddy Colt defeats Roberto Soto. The Hollywood Blondes defeat Tony Charles and myself. Hiro Matsuda defeats Lorenzo Perini. And George McCreary has a draw with Terry Sawyer. It's another fantastic card with the same results as the Orlando building. And that's going to be the same results all week. It's going to be the same results all month. All were going to sell out, and they were going to turn thousands, literally thousands and thousands of wrestling fans away that because the buildings wouldn't hold the people.
And what are you doing during this time?
Oh, I'm wrestling quite a bit. I'm defending my Florida title two times. In the month of May, once against Chris Markoff, and the other one I just mentioned against Johnny Valentine. I get one Southern Heavyweight title match with Dusty Rhodes. This is prior to Dusty turning babyface. He's a heel, and I work with him for the Southern title. And then I get one North American title match against, I mentioned that one earlier in the program here in West Palm. I don't win that championship, and I don't win Rhodes' belt. My brother and I, we managed to get two Florida tag title matches with the Hollywood Blondes, managed by Humperdinck, and we're not able to beat the Blondes for the championships, but I do hang on to my Florida championship through the month of May, and I'm proud of that, especially I got one of those matches against Johnny Valentine, and there weren't many times that you were able to beat Johnny Valentine, and somehow that night, in May, I was able to do that.
You worked with someone that you mentioned earlier in the show. Tell me about Redbeard.
Redbeard, I can't remember a whole lot about. I know he's been there quite a bit, on and off throughout 74. Even in 73, he was working there quite a bit. When I think about him, it reminds me of the pro that used to work out of Georgia. And I don't know if it's the same guy, but I'm not real familiar with Redbeard. Kent, I've been thinking about Redbeard, and it doesn't come back to me exactly who Redbeard was. There are other people there and that are going to come on the scene that are tremendous workers well, let's just jump right on in the next little segment here. I mean, the sellouts and the turning away crowds, they just keep coming, but so does the talent. So so we move into June of 1974. Okay, in June of 74, Bobby Duncombe shows up, and a guy called the Korean Assassin. The Korean Assassin is a Kobayashi, Strong Kobayashi. I mean, he's a fantastic Japanese wrestler. Jerry Briscoe is going to come in. Bob Armstrong is going to come in. Bob Roop is going to come in. Greg Valentine is going to come in. All of these guys, Bobby Duncombe, the Korean Assassin, Bob Armstrong, Jerry Briscoe, Bob Roop, Greg Valentine, all in one month are added to an already spectacular crew. When you think about all this outstanding talent that's already there in 1974, and you add these names to the mix, it's no wonder the sellouts are not going to stop. I mean, all these guys are going to get over, and when they get over, it's like a continuing, it's like a snowball's rolling downhill. It's just going to get bigger and bigger. And when Watts keeps bringing in this kind of talent, there's no way it's going to cease. These sellouts are not going to stop.
How are you guys getting around this period of time? Taking car? Are you guys on planes yet? What's going on?
Well, you know, things are really good. I mean, when you're selling out every building, and what they do is Eddie and Dad, they're now looking at how to expand these buildings. And every week you go in, for instance, to the Miami Beach Convention Center that used to be in the auditorium, which is a small building. They moved it into the convention center and set up for wrestling. But when we hit this time period, they bring these giant stands in. I mean, it's amazing. They must put 12,000 people in the Miami Beach Convention Center, massive crowds, because they're prepared for all these sellouts. They want to get as many bodies in there as they possibly can. So we're getting big payoffs. You know, let's just say a Miami house like that, that's got 12,000 people in it. You're wrestling on two matches from the top or the next to the last match. You're probably going to make $700 or $800 in 1974. That's a pretty darn good amount of money. You know, I don't know what it equates to, but I'm sure that's a pretty darn decent night. So, guys have been traveling by car. Ever since I came to Florida in 1970, guys have been traveling by car. But when this angle takes off and it just basically explodes, then guys start talking about flying. You know, rather than take that four-hour drive from Tampa to Miami on a Wednesday after TV and everything else that you've had to do that day, and you're not getting home until 2 in the morning, we started renting these planes. We would charter these private planes, about 7-passenger planes. It had two guys in the front for two pilots, basically. One's a co-pilot seat. You didn't have two pilots on the plane usually, but one of the wrestlers sits in that co-pilot seat. You got a row behind them of two and a row behind them of two. And then there's a jump seat in the back, it's called, for the seventh person. And we were cramming those planes so full of bodies, and we had all those big bags and belts and stuff in the bags. It was difficult to get those things off the ground. But business is so good that once we started charting these things on a Wednesday, for instance, instead of having to leave at 3 o'clock to go to Miami, around 5:30, 6 o'clock, we'd show up out there at the private airport. Tampa's private airport, the one basically right where today's present big airport is. It's across the runway, and it still sits there. And they'd have two private planes sitting there on the tarmac at that private airport, and the baby faces would pile onto one of those planes, and the heels would pile on the other. And these planes were almost always overloaded, man, flying. And that time of year, it's summertime, and the thunderstorms in Florida in the summer are just monstrous, especially in the Tampa area. For some reason, it's known as the lightning capital of the world, Tampa is. I mean, there's just so much lightning and so many huge thunderstorms that you're flying in these thunderstorms down there, more than coming back. As the air cools and it gets dark, thunderstorms kind of just fall apart. But in the late afternoon, 5-6 o'clock, and that sun's beating down, those thunderstorms get massive. And so it was a great way to travel. We were splitting that plane charter among 7 of us, which gave us you know, it wasn't that bad. And we were making these darn huge payoffs, and we're getting home early. Everybody was loving it. Not just the money, but loving the fact they could take these planes. But, you know, these private planes are like all private planes, and I've had my history in private planes, and they all scare me at times. And these were dangerous times. And I got a couple of stories here. I just want to throw in a couple of stories about flying on these planes. One of them is a trip from Tampa to Miami. And on this trip, Bob Armstrong had just started. And Bob Armstrong is scared to death of two things. One is a snake, and the second one is an airplane. And so somehow we talked Bob into taking the co-pilot seat up front. And so Bob gets up there, and we take off. We're probably 40 miles out of Tampa, south. We have to go around the thunderstorms because we're in a private plane, and you can only you can't get the altitude to get over one of these 40,000 foot high thunderstorms. You have to fly around them. So we had to fly out into the Gulf to get around one of these huge thunderstorms down around Sarasota, about 40, 50 miles south of Tampa. And the pilot was having such a problem with the, we weren't actually in the thunderstorm, but we're close to the edge of it, and it's just rocking and rolling us, and everybody's shaking and bouncing around, and Bob's up there watching him, and he's got the wheel, the pilot's got the wheel, but he, all of a sudden, the nose goes straight over. Maybe they hit a downdraft that just took the plane and shoved it down toward the ocean. And when it started down, the guy was trying to pull on it, but it wasn't reacting, you know. And we're in the back. Everybody in the back sees what's going on, too. But there's Bob sitting right next to him. And Bob Armstrong with a big old arms, man. I guess he figures that the guy just ain't strong enough. And he grabs his wheel because he has the same thing that the pilot has. He's got his own steering wheel and everything. He's obviously not using it, but he decides he is going to use it. He grabs that wheel, and he pulls that sucker back. We're all screaming, "No, Bob, no, no, no." And the pilot's going, "Let go, let go." I mean, everybody's screaming at him, and he literally pulls that plane back up till it levels itself out. And we were just like, wow, man, going all the rest of the way. That night, we were all half cussing him. You know, Bob, you're definitely not riding in the co-pilot seat going back. So, you know, we had those type of things. We flew into Jacksonville. It was a three-hour trip out of Tampa by car. It was about an hour flight by airplane. And we'd fly the same type of arrangement. Heels on one plane, baby faces on another. And I remember one night being there at Eddie was a pilot. He had his own plane. And he was very accustomed to planes. And I had been on these flights into Jacksonville many times, and it was in a small airport, had big, tall pine trees at both ends of the runway. So you had to come right over the pine trees and drop down quickly to get on the runway and have time to stop. Especially you got all these big guys on the plane and everything. So one night we're going to leave, and Eddie's out there talking to the pilot of our plane, and the other plane is loading up with the heels. And they get out and taxi over to the runway. And during the course of the few minutes I'm out there standing by Eddie and this pilot, they're looking at his plane, the plane we're about to get on. The guy goes, you know, "Hey, the old cow flaps here are looking pretty bad. We're just going to have to work on these. And yeah, this is bad and that is bad." And I'm listening to all that stuff. And then they crank up over there on the runway, the heels, and they give that plane all the power it's got. And we sit there, and I sit by Eddie, and the pilot's going to fly our plane in just a few minutes. And that plane starts down the runway, and it takes off, and I see those pine trees up there in front of it. I'm going, wow, I don't know. And the pilot of our plane goes, "I don't know. I don't know." He's like, "Boy, it's not going to do it." And then they just clear the top of the pine trees, and he turns to Eddie. And he goes, "You know, one of these nights, we're not going to get out of here with these things."
Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, that makes you feel good. Now we're about to board one of them, you know, got bad cow flaps. He's got all these problems with it. And we're overloaded. I get to looking at the bodies as we start to get on there. And you got Big Dusty on there, and you've got these big, huge guys. You got Armstrongs, and it's just unbelievable. It's like, oh my God, man, this is horrible. So we dealt with that, and that's it was a great thing to have those short flights. Great thing to be able to get home early, but boy, flying around those thunderstorms and things like this situation, and where you don't know what's going to happen, and sure enough. I think it's about a year later or a little more that one of those planes is going to go down, and it's going to cost one of them their lives.
One name I did want to ask you about, Ron, during this period of time was Ron Mikulogic was in Florida. Did you have any encounters with him?
None. No. And I don't remember much about Mikulogic. And I saw his name on some of the cards because, you know, I have a good friend, Barry Rose, obviously a good friend of yours as well, that helps me to put these cards together so that I have an idea of what's happening during each of these months. And it's been extremely helpful for me. And I noticed Mikel Ochak's name on there. But I don't think I ever worked with him the time he was here. So I wish I could give you more info on that. But that's about as far as I can go on that one.
One thing I did want to ask you, Ron, is what were the payoffs like during this period of time?
Oh, God, man. I was making between $2,000 and $3,000 a week.
Wow. In 74.
In 74. And, you know, and I don't know what Dusty was making or Pac Song or Gary Hart. You know, I mean, I was not on the bottom of the card, but I wasn't on the main event all the time. Occasionally I was on main events, but not all the time on main event. But that money was just tremendous for that time frame. Gosh almighty, just and guys were just loving it. I mean, you know, it was the dressing rooms were just on fire. It was just like it was wonderful to go to work. You didn't mind a bit to get on those, you know, to get on the plane or get in that car or whatever it was and go make that big bread because you knew it's going to sell out. You knew there were going to be thousands of them outside that were going to have to be forced to leave the grounds. It's just a phenomenal time to be a wrestler for sure. You know, let's take another look at it. One more spectacular card in Tampa. Now, this is in June of 1974. It's June 25th, 1974. And during this time frame, Gary Hart, he's offering a bounty for someone to put Dusty out of action. And there's a scheduled bounty match for the main event between Dusty and Giant Baba. I mean, what's Baba doing here in Florida when he's the big, huge star in Japan, owns that company, you know? So... That instead of it turning into a single bounty match between Baba and Dusty, and obviously Hart's going to offer some money to the heels if they can put Dusty out of business. Somehow this turns into a six man tag. I think they went to the ring. They were going to have one Gary Hart's down there, and he brings down the Korean assassin, and then he's going to bring down the Samoan, and then all of a sudden the single match going to turn into a six man tag. Dusty, Jerry Briscoe, and Morocco are going to wrestle against Giant Baba, the Korean assassin, and the Samoan, managed by Gary Hart. And now you can begin to see there's a pattern here. Hart's really leaning heavily on this Far Eastern talent to go after Dusty. You know, now he's got three of them, basically. He's got Baba here. He's got the Korean assassin here. And he has got Pac Song here. And you'll see in the next match how it accentuates it. The next match below that is Pac Song and Bobby Duncan, managed by Gary Hart. And they're going to lose to Mike Graham and Don Morocco. I'm going to defeat Bill Watts that night. Jerry Briscoe is going to defeat Buddy Colt that night. The Korean assassin, that's Kobayashi, is going to defeat Bob Roop. Pat Barrett and Salento Rodriguez are going to defeat Les Thornton and Greg Valentine. And Ali Vazari going to defeat Terry Sawyer. So when you look at that, you've got three of the very best heels ever to come out of the Orient on this one card. Giant Baba, Pac Song Nam, and the Korean assassin Strong Kobayashi. So everything's lining up perfectly for Gary Hart with this big Orient heels versus the babyface superstar Dusty Rhodes. And it is just cranked up. It is just doing phenomenal business. Dusty's bleeding every night. So much that I get concerned. I think a lot of us got concerned for Dusty because he was just... but at the same time, Dusty is just so turned on by what's happened to him and how the fans have taken to him. And he's willing to do whatever it takes, man. And he's really doing a fantastic job of it.
What can you tell me about Terry Sawyer, Ron?
Terry Sawyer was a great young worker, a lot of talent. I think he goes and makes quite a bit of money out west. Maybe in Oklahoma, But as a young guy, I was very impressed with Sawyer. And I thought he had a good future ahead of him. I'd never got to work with him. I didn't have any matches with him. He was a first or second match guy. And they never put him past that level while he was there. But he was going to make it to main events. He certainly had talent to get there.
We will return to 1974 Florida in just a moment. But first, a word about the latest Super Studcast. Super Studcast number 13, part one of the look at the Knoxville Wrestling War.
Wrestling wars have been few and far between, and none are exactly the same. The Stud experienced one of the most devastating of all time with his first wrestling company in 1979. Southeastern Championship Wrestling in Knoxville, Tennessee. This three-hour Super Studcast number 13 is one of the Stud's most difficult stories to tell, and you can hear it in his voice. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. Wrestling wars make you question everyone and everything, including yourself. Hear this history straight from the horse's mouth as Ron takes us on the hardest ride of his life in this two-part, fascinating Super Studcast number 13. Patrons are raving about part one, and the astounding finish of part two releases Tuesday, January 29th. If you've never experienced a Super Studcast, this is the one for you. At tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast.
Well, there you hear it. Super Studcast number 13, part one of our look at the Knoxville Wrestling War. It's already a record breaker. Check it out now. 90 minutes of wrestling history at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And don't forget the last unforgettable hour and a half, part two of the Knoxville Wrestling War. Rest of the story will be released on Tuesday, January 29th. Once again, available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. But Ron, let's return to 1974 in Florida. We've talked about a lot of things. Let's get back to Dusty Rhodes. What's going on with Dusty?
Well, Dusty's, like I said, Dusty's on fire, literally. He's just having a ball. And he's become the most popular wrestler in Florida history since his turn. And I believe that's undoubtedly a fact. I mean, Jack Briscoe had a tremendous run in Florida. Eddie Graham. There's a lot of tremendous guys that got over big time in Florida. But Dusty just eclipses all of them, in my opinion. And Eddie's a tremendously smart promoter. I mean, he's maximizing the exposure in so many ways. Dusty is a huge talent, and Eddie realizes it, and Eddie figures ways to make him an even bigger talent. And this is what you got to love about Eddie Graham. So Eddie sets up Dusty to do these once a week autograph sessions in every major wrestling city in the state. And what he does is, like, let's take, for instance, in Miami on a Wednesday. He sends Dusty down there in the early afternoon on a Wednesday, and thousands of fans will be advertised on the television show that if you want an opportunity to get an autograph from Dusty or you want to shake hands with Dusty, just get to meet Dusty. We're going to have an autograph session. They usually were about an hour, maybe an hour and a half sometimes, depending on how many thousands shows up. But thousands of fans arrive at the designated time advertised from the TV show. It's set up in each city, so it's at the same building where you're going to be wrestling later that night. So those people, and you, when you rent those buildings, you get them for the whole day. It's a great idea. So he just brings 2,000-3,000 that'll show up there to just get to shake hands with Dusty and meet Dusty. And it's a hell of an idea. And nothing gets a baby face over better than a baby face who spends time with his fans. And Dusty had that remarkable quality about him as being what he called the common man. And he could identify with fans of all different kinds. Did a fabulous job at these autograph sessions. Sometimes he would send others. I've been at a couple of them with him. And other baby faces would show up with him for these autograph sessions. So these daytime autograph sessions drew hundreds and sometimes thousands of crazy Dusty fans. They left each day with, they had an even stronger fervor for the big man out of Texas. They just loved him, man. It was just no end to the love for Dusty. there were so many fans waiting, thousands of fans waiting outside after the matches at night, but they had no chance of getting an autograph. I mean, you know, the guys are finished and, you know, they're tired and they want to go home. And it's really hard to put yourself in that position when you get into one of those gangs of huge crowd of people and they're all wanting autographs. Then you don't want to walk away. You want to stay. You don't want to insult anybody or make anybody mad. So it was a great idea to take this daytime opportunity to shake hands and to have that picture taken with Dusty. And it just served to enhance his popularity that much more.
What happens when you have an autograph signing like that and the babyface is one that doesn't particularly care to be around the fans in kayfabe or out of kayfabe?
Well, you know, if you own the company and you've set this up and you're Eddie Graham and you see a guy go in there and he doesn't do what he's supposed to do, then, you know, I would be afraid because Eddie's liable to pull one of those snake pit little deals and go off on somebody. So, you know, you wanted to go in and you wanted to please Eddie. You worked for Eddie. You wanted to please Eddie above all else because Eddie was such a bad man that you didn't want Eddie on you for any reason whatsoever. Dusty respected the hell out of Eddie, and Eddie loved Dusty. And that combination, they just took this thing and worked it to just a beautiful, beautiful thing, man. It was fabulous.
What else did Eddie do to try to get Dusty over even more than he was?
Well, he did a thing on the television program that I had never seen before. I don't know if it had ever been done before. This is an unprecedented step further in my estimation. Gordon announces on TV one day out of the clear blue, and we don't know anything about it. Usually don't know what's happening so far as with Gordon and that part of the business. But Gordon announces on TV the American Dream Contest. I think that was what they called it. And here's how it worked. Fans that were encouraged to send or bring any type of banner, artwork, or display of any kind that honored the American Dream to arenas around the state or to the Sportatorium when they do TV on Wednesdays or to the Tampa building, wherever there was wrestling, you could show up and have something that really made Dusty, would have made Dusty proud or Dusty happy. And fans were bringing these items every night. So this contest was obviously for the best representation of the American Dream. And it was going to last 4 weeks. Gordon says this is a 4-week deal. And we're going to take these things for 4 weeks. We're going to bring them into the Sportatorium. That's the place where they did the television programs, 106 North Albany there in Tampa. And we're going to store them there for 4 weeks. And then after the fourth week, we're going to bring Dusty on and he's going to pick out the one that he considers the best of all of them. The idea is just fantastic. I mean, fans just show their originality and creativity on a weekly basis. And the Sportatorium begins to fill up with everything imaginable being sent from fans from around the state and all over the state because Eddie was sending people down with vans to take all the stuff from Miami's crowd and bring them back to the Sportatorium and the next night Jacksonville's crowd and back to the Sportatorium. I mean, the Sportatorium is just literally full of Dusty Rhodes promotion products or whatever you want to call them. I don't know what the name would have been for them, but it was really a great idea. So each week, Gordon on the show shows the best of the entrees. Maybe about 10, they pick 10 items from that week because there's just not enough time to show all of them, just too many of them. And some are displayed each week behind Gordon on the set and throughout the Sportatorium as the weeks go by. So when fans came in to see the wrestling matches themselves, they could go through the Sportatorium out there in the ticket lobby once they got into the main arena, the stuff was everywhere and fans could just go and look at stuff, kill some time. And it was really a great setup, you know, So in the fourth week, the stuff's everywhere in the buildings. The fans are having a great time looking over the entries, and they wait for the TV match. So the last week they pull out the top 10 and arrange them behind Gordon on the set. They move the set and bring in Dusty when they get ready for him to pick the winner. So basically they put that big old set that Gordon used to deal with. They kind of push it off to the side, and they've got the top 10 things there that have been sent in by fans. And what an amazing sight those 10 things were. I mean, I only remember one. I wish I could remember more of them, because it was just such a beautiful idea. And it's a very interactive thing. It gets the fans involved in a great way, you know. So Dusty comes out, and he works it perfectly, obviously. You know, he compliments the different pieces, and they had the names of the person that made this and the person that made that. And Dusty would, you know, make a real nice compliment. Boy, what a beautiful thing this is. And, you know, what's that name? You know, oh, man, what, great, great. Love this, man. Love you having sent it in here. So I remember what the winner was, And that's unusual for me to be able to remember something like that. But this was such a beautiful thing that this person did. And I have no idea where the person came from or what his name was. But it was a beautiful piece of almost like driftwood, and it had been shellacked, and it was kind of shiny. And this is about 12 feet long, maybe 3 feet high. And it took two people, one person on each end, just to hold it up when they got ready to display it, to bring it up. They brought the 10 items up, and when they brought this one up, you know, I was like, wow, it's got to be the winner right here. So they've got this 12 by 3 foot high, big piece of board. It's all shellacked and really beautiful. Imagine a thick rope like you would find an anchor rope for a large boat, the type of rope that you would anchor up with or tie off to your dock. That's probably about 3 inches thick, and with that rope they spelled the words "American Dream" across that 12-foot board, and the rope and the letter N in the word American, which is the first word, and the end happens to be at the end of it, happens to be right in the middle of the board. At the center of that board, they left the rope longer, and they made a hangman's noose in it that hung down below the board. And I mean, as soon as I saw this one, I was like, wow, that's got to be the winner. And Dusty picked it. I mean, it was just a phenomenal piece of artwork, and just a great, great way to get fans involved, and to get someone over at the same time. All this is putting emphasis on the guy who has made this happen, and that's Dusty at this point. And every bit of this is right back to pushing Dusty. And you can't push him too hard, because they're just loving him. The fans are just eating it up. And these type of interactive events is something like this that involves fans. It made wrestling stronger and just made the company more profitable.
Did you do anything like that in Southeastern?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I really was intrigued by the whole deal, and I never forgot it. Now, this happens in 74, and in 75, I'm going to own my own company by then. I'm going to be involved, and I'm going to have my Southeastern Wrestling company started, and I'm going to do one of these types of contests. But I'm going to use a different type of wrestler. Dusty's a babyface, but I wanted to use a heel. I decided I want to use a heel, and I used the one who was the most despised and yet loved at the same time in that part of the state for 20 years. And you know who that is. That's Ron Wright. It can only be Ron Wright. And Ron Wright running that mouth, and you know, and it went great. We had to store some of the things sent because the studio was just not nearly large enough. We didn't have a sportatorium. We were shooting in a television studio, and we would just bring in some items during the week, and then we'd store them in houses, friends' houses or wherever, and then we'd bring them back in on Saturdays and show some of them again. But it's a lot different pieces than what was sent for Dusty, because Ron Wright's a heel, you know, and he had a hell of a lot of heat in 1975. When I first went in there, I'm working as a heel and he's working as a babyface. But by 75, he's turned back heel. And I've turned to babyface. So he's got a lot of heat there, you know, and the stuff that came in, it was funny. It was funny and fabulous, some of it, you know. So Wright would come out each week and he'd make fun of everybody and make fun of what they had sent. And then some stuff would just be hilarious. And he'd just get downright ornery about it. About who made this? I hate this. Look at this crap. This is terrible. You know, he was doing his Ron Wright thing and it was really, really getting over. So it was like, wow, what a great idea. And that interactive thing, we got to doing more of it as time went by. We got the mink coat tournaments and we did things. We figured out that interactive concept is tremendous for sports entertainment.
Who won the Ron Wright contest, Ron?
Well, there again, it's kind of like the Dusty deal. I don't remember the gentleman's name, but gosh almighty, I will never forget his work. The creator, he was a woodworker, a craftsman from the Smoky Mountains. And gosh, there's some really, really great craftsmen up there in those mountains. They can do it. They can carve anything. They just work with wood and they just make some fabulous stuff. And this guy had hand carved a giant rattlesnake. I'm talking about a huge rattlesnake. And he carved the whole snake, and it was coiled up and ready to strike. And it had big rattlers sticking up behind the head of the snake. And he had mounted it on a beautiful 3-foot square piece of polished hickory. It was a beautiful piece of wood. Just the platform it was sitting on was gorgeous. And a snake stood up about 3 feet high, and it was about 3 feet across. And the snake itself, it would have been enough. For me, that would have been the winner. Just the guy, he just carved a fabulous, the Eastern Diamondback snake. Wow, it was just wonderful. But the best part about the whole deal was the snake could have won the award and it would have been picked undoubtedly, but was the head of the snake. And this guy had carved a Ron Wright face on the head of that snake. It looked exactly like Ron Wright. It had his tongue flicking out like it was a snake's tongue flicking out of his mouth. And below the head on the platform the snake was attached to was a beautiful copper plate. It was about 4 inches high and about 8 inches long. And engraved on the plate were these words. It said, "Diamondback Rattlesnake." Instead of rattlesnake, rattle, like right, rattlesnake. I was like, wow. I saw that thing when I came in the studio the day we were doing the finals for the deal. And I was like, gee, money, look at this, man. I mean, it was absolutely a phenomenal piece of work.
As we begin to wrap things up, Ron, we want to remind everyone that you can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. You just have to like his page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter, at Ron Fuller Welch. Don't forget the historic Super Studcast number 13, about Ron Fuller's personal wrestling war in 1979 in Knoxville, is available right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99 for 3 total hours of classic wrestling knowledge. Part 2 will be released on Tuesday, January 29th. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Also, I want to remind you, you can follow me on Twitter at GreatBrianLast, and you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. Don't forget the classic Southeastern and Continental Lost Territory DVDs on sale now at tnstud.com. Ron, you have anything you want to say about these great DVDs?
I just want to thank all the fans that have purchased them. I just have been inundated with comments. Fans really love these. And some of the comments are about, you know, how they take me back and I haven't watched it myself. There are a tremendous number of memories in these things. And for people that have never got to see any Southeastern or Continental and the great Gordon Sully doing the commentary, these are really, really a special item. And they're only $39.99. And we're going to pay the shipping for you for free. 5 DVDs, 12 hours, 67 matches. Just a real nice 5-pack of DVDs of old history and old school stuff.
A great way to discover the Lost Territory, Southeastern and Continental, once again at tnstud.com. Ron, where are we going next week? What are we going to discover on the Studcast next week?
Well, we're going to next week. I think we're going to get into some really specifics about Dusty's matches, what type of matches they are, and how he's getting over, and what he's having to do to make it happen. Watts is going to turn on me. Bill Watts and I have been tag team partners since he arrived. Watts is going to turn heel on me, and I'm going to have my first 60-plus minute match ever in Jacksonville, Florida, against Buddy Colt. And I'm going to lose my Florida title in the month of July. So a lot of things going on in the next one. And Florida is just really wound up. Since May the 14th and the night that Dusty turned babyface, every single town has been sold out. Every single town has turned people away. That's going to continue during June. It's going to continue into July. And it's just a remarkable thing that happens in the state of Florida in 1974 with wrestling.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.